Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming. It really was the last hour. The room is really loud with the noise of people discussing the sources and learning Torah together, and it's really a wonderful thing. And we appreciate you joining us in our learning. This morning, I would say, is a sort of different presentation or shiur than those of you who came on Wednesday experience, last Wednesday. Aside from the fact that it's a difference in topic, the goal of this type of learning is to get a taste of what we do here in the Beit Midrash every day in the morning. The members of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, every morning we are learning this year about the sixth parak of Bava Metzia, which is all about employment law. And I think the difference is when you really immerse yourself in a topic and try to get at the essential concepts involved and how those concepts then relate to all the intricate details of each topic, you get a sense of how complex halacha is, how halacha relates to all sorts of issues and considerations, and how robust of a legal system our Jewish tradition really affords to us. So again, the topic we're talking about today is the question essentially of when an employer, agree to an employment agreement, what actually happens? And now this is something that's very interesting about halacha. You take something that seems to be so simple, right? You have an employer, a boss says, will you work for me? The worker says yes. Seems like everything is simple, but truthfully, it's actually quite complicated. In truth, it's not 100% clear from a halachic perspective why that should be binding at all. So I'm going to try to make this as interactive as possible. Then to begin with a question, what problems, based on the sources that we read today, exist when trying to form an employment agreement? Right? If just saying, I will work for you, sure, no problem, and the boss says, I will pay you, what problems do we run into?
We haven't made a kingdom.
So problem number one, very good, thank you. Problem number one is that generally, to commit to something financially, at least, in Jewish law, requires what we call a kinyan, an act of transaction. So to take a typical example, if I agree to buy your house from you, and we sit down to coffee, and we talk about how much money I'll pay you, and you agree, sure, sounds good, and then we walk out of that lunch meeting, I'm not committed to anything at that point. I might have made a promise, certainly it's advisable, morally and religiously, to keep your promises. But I have no responsibility to buy your house, and you have no responsibility to sell your house until we do an act of transaction. Now there are many types of transactions in halacha. You can, when we're dealing with a movable object, you pick up the object, that signifies that you are agreeing to buy that object. And when we talk about real property, there's the idea of a contract. Writing out a contract for the property and the worth of the property is binding. But just verbally agreeing to work for someone doesn't seem to constitute a kinyan at all. So what then is binding the employee to actually doing his job or her job? But the second question, which is a bit more complex, exists even if you do make a kinyan. Does anybody want to volunteer the second question? I know it's a bit complex. What are you making the kinyan on? Right, which, although grammatically not necessarily so easy to understand, the halachic grammar is different. You make kinyanim on things, which means that in Jewish law, generally, these transactions, these kinyanim, need to apply to particular objects. I can buy an object from you. I can even, if I borrow money from you, and I then have to pay you back, my assets are encumbered by that loan. What happens when I simply agree to work for you? What am I giving to you? What consideration does the employee give to the employer? It's not 100% clear. My time? That's sort of an inanimate sort of consideration. If you took a look at source number two, to give you a bit of background, the Gemara there is talking about is as follows. If you had two people who own a field together, so the Gemara talks about, according to one opinion, they can voluntarily agree to split that field, and divide that field into two, whereby one partner gets one end of the field and one partner gets the other end of the field. And the Gemara says when that happens, you then need to build a wall in between the two fields. Well, the Gemara says even if they agree to do that, who cares? What are they missing? A kinyan. There's no active transaction. Just saying we'll split doesn't obligate them to anything. And then the Gemara says there's something called a kinyan sudar. Right? So when one, if you've seen this, maybe you've gone to a wedding or something like that, somebody gives their pen or their handkerchief over to the other party, which signifies we are agreeing to do the following transaction. But then the Gemara says that's still not enough. Because it's still what we call in halacha a kinyan devarim. That is simply a promise. I am making a commitment to do something. But that also isn't binding. Even if you hand over the handkerchief. At which point the Gemara then answers, no, what they're committing to is each side of the field. So when we split, I get that side, you get the other side, and then the halacha requires us in such a situation to build a wall. But in our case, in a case where you have an employer and an employee, again, what is that object? What is the equivalent of each side in that particular field? It's not 100% clear. The question really is, every time you have an employment contract, how is it ever binding? Is it ever binding? Yeah, good question.
In the case of both classes, do you need to specify who gets which side, or can you sort that out afterwards?
I think you do.
So I don't think it's the side.
Yeah, that's what it means. So that is part of the question. Now, if you looked in your sources 3 to 4 to 5, I did present three different approaches to answer this issue. And just to point out, what we often do when we learn Gemara is sort of the opposite of what we're doing here today. So usually when you learn Gemara, you look at all the details of the different concepts in the Gemara. Very specific technical details in each case of what happens when one party backs out, the other party backs out, how much do they owe, how much has the hijab been done, and from all those details, if you analyze all of them, you then come to an understanding of the general concept, which is what actually happens when an employer and employee agree to an employment contract. The Gemara never explicitly addresses this. It never says this is how it works. What we do when we learn Gemara is we try to analyze all the different sources and then come to a conclusion. So in sources 3, 4, and 5, I presented to you with three different approaches. Would anybody like to offer the approach that resonated most with them? Right, so we had three different approaches. We had the source number 3, we had from Rothenberg. And what does he suggest? What are you committing to? Who are you committing? Not nothing. In source number 3, you're committing yourself. That the object of an employment contract is the employee. So just as when you buy a merchandise, so then you're agreeing to buy the merchandise, in a sense, when the employer agrees to pay the employee, he's buying the employee. And in fact, if you look at source number 3, this is from the Maharam Rothenberg, one of the prominent Ashkenazic Rishonim medieval commentators from Germany. He actually compares an employee to an Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave. Obviously, slavery in the Torah is a more complicated topic to address fully, but we do have this concept whereby you have the opportunity. If, for instance, are destitute, you had no way of supporting yourself, you have the ability to sell yourself to someone else. And it's for usually a period of 6 years. And after those 6 years, they support you. And in return for supporting you, you are their slave. And you do what they want you to do. And Maharam Rothenberg, although maybe not an equation, and whether or not an employee is actually a slave or sort of like a slave is a longer discussion, which we have discussed this year at great length, but the Maharam Rothenberg is suggesting that indeed an employee is akin to a slave in this way. What you're giving over is yourself. That is the object of the transaction. Now, you don't have to go as far as the Maharam Rothenberg to say this approach. What others suggest is, while it's not slavery, at least it's what we call a shibud, a commitment. You are committing yourself to at least finish this job. He doesn't own you, but he does have a sort of legal hold over you in that period. That would be one approach. Any questions on that before I move on to the next one? It's quite controversial, I would say. Now, if that were the case, I would ask you, do you think then the employee should have financial liability if he then decides to back out? Or ask the second question, do you think the employee should be able to back out when they want to? If they decide midway through the job, they just don't want to do it anymore. Should they have that ability intuitively? Who says yeah? Why do you think so?
Because if he does come up with some funding to pay out the remaining amount of the contract, whatever, then he should be able to get out.
Ah, so Albert is going a little bit further here, saying that if you really compare it to a Jewish slave also has the ability to pay out the terms of their agreement and then free themselves. That is a good point. However, if you didn't want to take it so far, You could argue that no, right? If you really didn't want to take the equation to ad libitum to its fullest extent, if you're really saying I, for the duration of my employment, am committing myself to this job, intuitively you might have said, of course you can't back out. He owns you, or she owns you. Your employer has a financial hold over you such that you have a requirement to finish what you promised to do. So that would be one approach. There is the second approach, which I'd like to suggest, was from the Ketzot HaChoshen in source number 4, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Heller, and he takes it a bit less of an extreme stance. And that is, if you think about it, when you agree to work for someone, essentially you're agreeing to do a job, they're agreeing to pay you. What value are you committing to them? If I were to assign a financial value to your commitment to them, what would it be? It would be the amount that you are getting paid, right? So if I decide that, for instance, I will mow your lawn, and you decide I will pay you $20 for it, what I owe you then is $20 worth of labor, right? Because that's what you agreed to pay me. Now, what is the recipient of that commitment? So the Torah Choshen implies here, and others say this as well, we have something in Halacha called a Shibud Nechasim, where I commit my estate to the value of an obligation. So just like in any case when you borrow money from someone, per se is short on cash and borrows money. It turns out later they don't have the money to pay at the time when the loan is due. What is the halacha in such a situation? You say?
Merchant of Venice.
Right. See, the point is that you had, they'll explain to me afterward. You're entitled to agree to compensate yourself from their assets. So you can take property from them. This is what the banks do when you cannot pay back, your mortgage in time. You have the right to the assets in their estate. So when I agree, then, to work for you for a certain price, I am guaranteeing through my assets that I provide you with that salary, a salary's worth of labor. And that would be a second approach. Again, should there be a financial obligation according to such an approach? I would argue yes, at least to the amount of the salary. I should be financially obligated to the terms of that contract, such that I should owe you at least a salary's worth of money if I don't complete that contract. That's what I would argue logically based on that. Yes, Ezra.
Just to bring up something that we discussed in our group together, would that mean that if someone backs out of a job immediately, like close to when they start, they have to pay that full amount of money to the employer?
So we'll have to get to specifics as we'll see, but I'd say logically, if you did a certain amount of work and then backed out based on this approach, you should have to pay the difference between the value of the work that you did according to the rate that you agreed upon and the totality of the contract. So if I agreed to work for you for 10 hours and I didn't do so, and now I owe you 9 hours worth. That's what I would have said, logically at least. Fair? Yes. And this is a good point. So look, what you're asking is as follows. Right. What you're asking is as follows. Can you remind me, please? I'm sorry.
Esther.
So Esther is asking is as follows. Beyond simply the salary that I owe to you, there are other potential, at least circumstantial losses also. If you hire me to do a job, it's likely that I'm producing something for you that can then make money or at least save you money. And what if you lose then an opportunity to make that money or lose that money because of the fact that I stopped working for you and I reneged my agreement? So this is another important question. I think part in terms of this approach, I think what you need to ask is, what are you committing yourself to? You might argue that I only committed myself to $100 because that's what you were going to pay me. I didn't commit myself to. Now there might be another consideration, which is that considered damage? So, if I take a hammer and smash open your window, I did not commit to paying you for that, but it doesn't matter because the Torah makes me pay for that. That's called damages. So, the other question would be, do we consider it damages if by reneging from an employment agreement, I cause you a loss? And that's something that I do hope to get to. Yes?
So, it sounds like when you enter into a contract, you automatically, according to second opinion, your estate goes up as collateral. So, does that mean if you don't have the cash to pay, they can see property?
Okay. In the case of a loan?
No, just in the case of, like, where I, like, in the case of the following.
Okay.
So could you argue that the estate is put up as collateral implicitly in the agreement, and therefore if I back out and I can't pay, you can seize property?
You could have argued that. Well, let's see how it actually plays out. But I think you could argue that based on this approach. And that's a fair argument based on this approach. Again, only up to the value of your agreement. Meaning, even if my estate's worth $1 million, you can't take all $1 million. You can take $100 from that $1 million estate. The third approach, and I think it's actually quite interesting, although sort of humorous, is that what are you committing to? Anyone remember source number 5? What are you committing to, Joyce? You want to say? You like this one, right?
Time.
Time, which essentially means there is no object. Meaning you're making a promise. You're saying, I will work for you. Is that binding? Not really. The agreement is, we agree to a rate, you know, so let's say I'm getting paid $10 an hour, or I'm getting paid $25 to finish the job. If I do that, then you will pay me. That's what you're agreeing to do. If I don't, then you will not. And we prorate it. So if I do $2 worth of work, that's the rate I get. I have no responsibility, at least based on the essential agreement, to actually finish. And this is an argument that is made, and then it goes both ways. Maybe even the employer is not actually committing to providing work for the employee. They're simply saying that if you do the work, I will pay you for it. And if you don't do the work, either because you can't or because I decide I don't need it, I won't pay you for it. Now, according to this approach, would you say naturally, should there be any liability? No. Why should there be liability? If I work, you will pay me. You're committed to doing that. That's all work. It's a conditional arrangement. When the work is done, I will pay you for it. If the work is not done, I won't. Right. And I shouldn't have to. I'm not guaranteeing I'm going to finish the job. Maybe at least morally, let me note that these three approaches sort of may depend on the terms of the agreement. Right. I think a number of people mentioned that, you know, often nowadays, all this could be laid out in a contract. And we'll talk about, well, what happens if you quit, what happens if you don't quit, and what are the repercussions. So I think there is value in just examining the essential details of a contract. Without, what is halacha when there are no specifications? What is the baseline halacha? And in terms of these approaches, it really might depend. So if you write a contract, maybe you then do switch from, approach number 3 to approach number 1, right? Meaning I could argue that if you just verbally agree to work for someone, that's not really binding, at least to the degree that you have to finish the job. But if I then after verbally committing, sign a contract, or take a handkerchief, or do another type of kinyan, then I am enhancing my commitment to, let's say, the Maharam Mirunberg's version, or even at least the Ketzos's version of this agreement, right? So these things might be flexible. It might really depend on the what you said and what you committed yourself to. And in fact, the Chazon Ish, Rishai Karelitz, I got his name right? Oh, sorry. Rishai Karelitz, suggests that there are three types of kinyanim, and all these are options. It's not set in stone, this is the way it works. It really depends on the terms of your agreement and what kinyanim you do and what you stipulate about those transactional acts. Yes? What you might suggest then is that if I just verbally commit, I'm not really committing myself. But if I then say, I am going to work for you, and I write it out, and I didn't really need to just to get paid, right?
Even Rav Moshe Feinstein would agree
right.
with either team.
Right, and I'll note that even Rav Moshe Feinstein is not sure about, he says there's two different ways of looking at it. He's not sure as to whether or not this approach is the right one. But he says, he wonders, maybe it is. Maybe even if I do a kinyan, says Rav Moshe, maybe it's still source number three. A kinyan, I hand over the handkerchief, and that just means that if I work, you will pay me. I'm still not committing to doing it. In terms of approach number three, it would be very intuitive that you can back out, right? This wouldn't be a novel idea at all. Of course you can back out. I'm not committing to finishing it. I'm just committing to, if I do work, this is the rate that I will get paid. But there is no real commitment to actually finish the job. So now that we've discussed the theory behind the concept of an employment agreement, let's move to some of the ramifications in terms of, number one, can you back out? When can you back out? And if you do back out and it causes a loss in one form or another to the employer, what are the ramifications of doing so? So if you take a look at source number six, at this point, we are simply talking about a verbal agreement. But what the sources of the Gemara generally make clear is that you do, as an employee, have the right to quit. You might face a financial penalty for doing so, but you are not, at least generally, required to ensure the job is finished. You have the right to say, I don't want to do this anymore. If you take a look at source number six, here the Gemara says, if a person hires workers and they deceive the boss, deception, according to at least one interpretation of the Gemara, means they say we don't want to do it anymore. Or the employer deceives them. All they have against each other are grievances, complaints. And in this verbal agreement itself, again, the Mishnah talks about simply a case where the employer says, I want you to work for me. The employee says, sure. They agree upon a rate. If that's all that happens, number one, the employee or the employer can back out. Number two, no financial repercussions, at least at this point, for doing so. Okay? Not only that, if you take a look at source, and this is what's clarified, take a look at source number seven, which where the Aruch HaShulchan sort of explains this idea, and the reason is because, look, as although I committed to doing a job for you, you could tell the employer, look, get someone else to do it. Okay, so I committed, I changed my mind. You get someone else, and the employer can say, you go and find another job. Now, if I can't do that, that gets into a different discussion, which we'll hopefully get to. But again, a verbal commitment in and of itself, with at least in a case where the worker can find another job, is not binding in this case. And that's worth noting. Again, if I decide to buy a field from you and I do an active transaction, we agree to it, the person who sold the field can't say, look, I don't want to do it anymore, find another field. Right? That's not usually a recourse in halacha. You can't just decide to tell them to go somewhere else. Once you commit to something, usually it's binding. In this case, the Mishnah clarifies that that is not so. However, we even see this is the case, not only when it was just a verbal agreement, But even when the employee begins working, they actually start the job. Now, I might have suggested that once you start, that suggests a higher level of commitment. Right now, I begin, right? Coupled with the fact that it's much more inconvenient for an employer to get someone to finish a half-done job and to sort of be this limbo status whereby the job is sort of done, sort of not done. And it really puts the employer in a pretty compromising situation. Nevertheless, it is clear that you do have the ability, even after you start working, to say, I don't want to do it anymore. Right? I don't want to finish the job. I'm sorry. I can't. And leave. Although, as we'll see, especially in the case where you started working, you might then have to suffer a financial loss for doing so. And this, if you take a look at source number 9, this is just from, taking a step back. Take a look at source number 8. What's interesting is the Gemara seems to give a source for this from the Pasuk itself. Right? Take a look at source number 8. V'amar Rav, Rav says, Poel yachol achazor bo afilu b'chatzi hayom. A worker can retract back out of an agreement even midway through the day. Dikatit, as it writes in the Pasuk, Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim, Avadaihem, the lo avadim v'avadim. A very fascinating idea that the Jewish people are slaves to God and are not slaves to other slaves. That we're meant to be able to dedicate our time toward God only and not to be committed to anybody else. Such that if I agree to work for someone, the halacha gives me the ability to say, I don't want to commit my time to you anymore because had I, according to the simple understanding, not been able to do that, that would have been akin to being a slave to someone other than God. And therefore, says the Gemara, you have the ability to back out of an employment contract. And if you look at source number 9, this is pretty much agreed upon. It's just a later source that I thought said it pretty explicitly, right? Rabbi Yaakov Shai Blau here in Pechei Choshen says that even if you begin working and you began the job, you still have the right to back out of the deal. Now, there's two things that are interesting about this. Yes, on the one hand, you are able to back out of an employment agreement. However, how does the Gemara know that you can? What did the Gemara need to bring to derive this idea? It brought a pasuk, a source from the Torah. Now, if something's intuitive, if something is obvious, should it need a source from the Torah? Should it require a pasuk or a verse? Right? If something is obvious, it's obviously true. We don't need necessarily a source from the Torah to tell me that. I'm trying to think of a good example. You wouldn't need a source generally for something that it's obviously just follows from the logic of something. So, for instance, if the Torah says that there's a fine for damaging, I don't need a source to tell me that just smacking someone in the face is considered damaging. Now, the specifics might be true, might be explicated. So the point is, what I'm saying is, if you go with source the third concept here, that when you commit to doing a job, what you commit to is, if you do the job, you get paid. Okay? Should you need a source from the Torah telling you that you can quit? If my commitment simply was, if I do the job, then I will get paid, and if I don't, then I won't. Should I need the Torah to tell me you can quit because you're not a slave? Right, it is not, though, if we're going with the third source, and you shouldn't. Right, if you really take your Moshe's viewpoint here, which is, you're not really committing to anything. You're just simply saying, if I do the job, you will pay me. And the employer says, yes, if you do the job, I will pay you. We are not saying, I'm going to finish. Why do I need a verse telling me that you can quit? Shouldn't that be obvious?
Because if you have a verse, then you might have said that it's not that you know whether she would
make it.
Maybe is saying there is no Shiyabud, and we know there's no Shiyabud because of this puzzle.
Right, so you could say that this pasuk teaches you not like the other two approaches. They wouldn't like that, right? The other two approaches, right? Because then they'd be against the pasuk. But that's what you could say if you want to take the third approach. However, and I'll note that there are really two different approaches in the Rishonim as to what this is really telling you. So if you look at the Tosfot actually on that Gemara, it says the point of this Gemara is not that you can back out. We know that even without the Pasuk. Of course, you can back out of an agreement. What this Gemara is telling you is that at least in certain cases, you can back out without financial penalty. That's the point. The point is that if you, and if this is one of our original questions, if you do half the job and quit, we could have suggested, well, you shouldn't get paid at all. You committed to doing the job. Why should I pay you for a half-done job? At which the Gemara says, no, you can back out and still receive salary for the job you've done until that point. Now, again, if you think that the commitment here is one where, at the very least, you know, you're not guaranteeing finishing the job, or you're not giving yourself over to doing it, so then that makes sense. Of course, you shouldn't need a pasuk to teach you, a verse to teach you that you can do so. However, there are Rishonim that say that indeed, although when you begin working, you are indeed committing yourself, that is, that working itself, beginning the job, constitutes an act of transaction, just like when I hand over money to someone to buy a property, or just like when I pick up an object, but beginning to do the job, that is an act of transaction, a commitment. Nevertheless, the reason you can back out is only because the Torah allows you to. Sort of a special dispensation which applies to certain types of workers, but really, you should not be able to back out. Without this pasuk, if it were not for this concept that we are servants to God and not servants to other servants, you would not have been able to back out of an arrangement. You would have had to finish the job. Now that approach to this Gemara then works much better with one of the first two approaches. Again, certainly, if what we're saying is that by agreeing to do a job, you're giving yourself, the transaction is on you. You are almost selling yourself to your boss for the duration of your employment, then this makes a lot of sense. Of course, I would have thought logically, intuitively, you should not be able to back out, and the Torah needs to tell you that although you're doing that, you can still back out because you don't take it so far. You're not a complete, full-fledged slave. At least, according to a simple explanation of this Gemara, yeah. Right. This is a question. I think what he would be saying is that it is a Maisa Kinyon, again, sort of just locking in the rates.
So what is the Kinyon on that? Right. What is a Maisa Kinyon if there's no Dabar HaMikdash?
So I think what that is saying is what you receive is the work that is done. And so as I said, we talked about this before, in certain cases in Halacha, when you receive a consideration, even without a formal act of transaction, when you receive something, you then intuitively agree to give something in return.
Okay.
Right? So essentially, again, to clarify, the point of an act of transaction is to signify that you're committing to doing it. Because when I just talk, that's a commitment. When I actually do something about it, I pay you, that symbolizes a greater commitment to doing it. Right? So if I get something in return, I also have that same, what we call, commitment, mental commitment to doing my part of the bargain. I get something, and then I give you something also. So that would be...
Even though there's no kingdom, there's still an obligation.
Okay, that might be where I'm putting it. Maybe we'll pick up this. Okay, so that is in terms of backing out. Now, another question which arises is, what if I not only have a verbal agreement, but I actually do an act of transaction? So we write a contract. Or we do the handkerchief. Or one of those, one of the typical kinyanim. Does that change the equation? The Gemara says I can back out of the deal, but maybe that's only referring to a verbal commitment. What if I then enhance my commitment by writing a contract or doing one of these acts of transaction? So, if you take a look at source number 10 and number 11, this is an argument already in the Rishonim and also in the Acharonim, the commentaries on the Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch. Take a look at source number 10. Says the Ritva, V'dat mori harav, and the opinion of my master, my teacher is, She'en kol dinei mishlatenu v'gemara de'ala el b'mi she'sachar po'alim ba'amira below kinyan. That all the laws in our Mishnah and the Gemara which comments on it only refer to someone who hires verbally. Verbal contracts. Verbal contracts, that's when you can back out even without repercussion. She'en mitchayvu po'alim v'kinyan. If the workers do a kinyan, act a transaction, they have to do the job. Even if, says the Ritva, not only do they have to do it, even if something happens, they're compelled to stop. They get sick or something like that, they're still compelled to finish, either through themselves, or through others, or to compensate the employer financially. Says the Ritva, what happens when you write that contract? You know what you're doing? You are then committed to doing the job and making sure it gets finished. No matter what. That is what you are committing to. Right? Specific performance in legal terms. You are obligated to then ensure that the job gets done. Even if you're physically incapable of doing it, get someone else to do it. So it would seem then, okay, that might be one option of explaining it. The Shach, if you take a look at source number 11, vehemently argues against this, right? Take a look at the Shach. He quotes the Ritva in those first two lines. Take a look at the second line here. If you look at all the other Rishonim, all the other commentaries on the Talmud, they don't make this distinction. They don't say that if you make a kinyan, then you have to finish the job. They must not agree to this Ritva. They think that you can back out even if you do make a kinyan. And that's, in my humble opinion, what I think is true. And he gives two reasons. So first he says, look, the Torah, Gemara quotes the Pasuk, a verse in the Torah. The Torah says, you're allowed to back out. That's what the Torah says. It shouldn't matter whether or not you do a contract, you accept money for it. These things are relevant. The Torah says you can back out. You should be able to back out. That's number one. Number two, says the Ritva, the Shach here of Shatai ben Meir HaKohen in source number 11. Look at the last four words of the source. V'gam nir'ed dehavi kinyan varim. Says the Shach, even if you make a transaction, what is the problem? What does that transaction relate to? It's just a transaction of work. Just saying, I'm going to do the job for you. That's not binding in Allah. That's a promise. You should keep promises. I do want to mention that beyond the legal and financial ramifications of all these occurrences, it is still very important morally and religiously to commit to your word. And that's a whole other topic. Generally, not just in terms of employment contracts, but any contract. So if I agree to buy a house from you, even if we don't actually do a kinyan, I should keep my word. And there's a discussion of masa matan be'emuna, being loyal and faithful in business, and it's really important. But nevertheless,
there's a curse for people who don't do it, isn't there?
Correct, there's a curse for people who don't do it, and that only applies to certain circumstances, and there's a lot to say about just the moral aspect of being honest in business and fulfilling your commitments, and when you're allowed to, what if the situation changes? These are all discussions. But in terms of a legal commitment, promises are not binding. If I promise to do something, that's not binding. So the Shah says to Ritva, what'd you do? You took a handkerchief and you said, okay, I'm going to work for you. That's not binding. That's a promise. So what does the handkerchief do? Even if you did a ma'asa kingdom, you don't have a davar hanigna. What could the Ritva then respond?
Sure you do.
Yeah, you do. It's you. You're the davar hanigna. You are giving over yourself. That is the object of the transaction. Right? So this distinction, this argument between the Shach and the Ritva, again, might relate to the general concept of what is the object of an employment contract. Is it simply an agreement? If I work for you, you will pay me. Is it simply the assets? Or, meaning even if you argue that I'm committing my assets, but I can agree to not do it anymore. You're right, I committed financially, so I'll pay you. Or at least whatever I owe you in terms of my salary. That doesn't mean that I need to actually finish. Why should I have to finish? But the Ritva is saying, no, it's more than just that. You're committing yourself. And if you commit yourself, of course you have to finish. At least if you make a kinyan. Okay, so I think what we discussed until now, again, before we get to the... So at this point, we discussed generally what is the conceptual underpinnings of an employment agreement and how that relates to whether or not you can back out and when you can back out. That's what we see at this point. What I want to do next is differentiate between different types of employees and then talk about the financial repercussions of what happens when you cause a loss to the employer. But before that, I saw a question. Any questions? Yes.
I'm trying to imagine how this is working.
Okay.
So we know that poor people, let's say in Los Angeles, there's a place where they line up, an employer says, come, I need a wall painted, I need something done, I need whatever it is. So there's the employee doesn't see what the actual job is, because if this is I imagine in Gemara times it's the same thing.
Good.
So he's not aware of what the working conditions are.
Good.
The employer could say it's an easy job and it isn't. He could say it's not a dangerous job and it is. The employee also could assume that he isn't have a problem with heights, and when he gets on the ladder, he does have a problem with heights. There's all sorts of unknowns. But most of the unknowns are what information the employer gives, and what they're not saying is leave me either. In other words, I'm telling you it's an easy job, and it isn't. So I'm actually being less than honest with the employee. There's all sorts of things going on here, lack of information. You just don't know what's going on. And you're making it a piecemeal job rather than a per-hour job. And again, if I'm committing to something without seeing it, how can I commit? So the question is, when is the verbal agreement there? When the employer picks me up in the marketplace and I say, glad to do it, or when I actually see what's involved with it and say, wait a minute, you said it was an easy job, I'm looking at this, this is not a one-man job in half a day, this is a 12-man job in 6 weeks. There's just too much unknown with all this going on.
Well, how thoughtful is the person agreeing to this job, right? It's part of the question. Meaning, I do want to relate to, I think, because one of the things you mentioned was the difference between a time-based employment and a task-based employment. But there is a discussion a lot as to what I actually agree to do. So if I agree to chop trees for you, or if I agree to mow your lawn, you can't just make me do something completely different, right? There is, indeed,
But even in the chopped trees, if most of the trees in that area are one kind of tree, which I know are easy to chop down, and yours happen to be a different kind, I could say, I assume your trees were like everybody else's, elms, and they turn out you have one of the few oak orchards there, and it's a different kind of thing. I'm making assumptions based on what I know of the area, and it's something completely different.
You can make an informed decision. Just because it's verbal doesn't mean you have to do it without knowing any details, right? You can decide to make that verbal decision once you know which trees. And that's fair.
If the guy lies and there's a nice Kenya, the Kenya is presumably bought the Kyra.
I think is if you are, foolish or naive enough to simply agree to do a job without knowing details, and that might have some bad applications for you. But you can say, well, I'm not just agreeing to do, let's say, chopping trees, chop trees for you generally. I'm agreeing to chop those trees. It could be we make this, and the Gemara actually does talk about the distinction between whether you went to the place of work or you didn't go to the place of work. These are all considerations. And I think it does depend upon the terms of your agreement. Did you stipulate a certain type of work or a certain difficulty of work? I will just add that there is discussion, which I thought of getting into, but we're not going to have time to. If you're a timely worker and you finish your job early, meaning, let's say, I'm cleaning your house, and I'm being cleaning it for the day at six hours and 12 to 6 p.m. And I finish in 3 hours. And I agree to clean your house for 6 hours. But now, there's 3 hours, I'm not going to get paid for them. That's not fair. So what the Gemara says there is, the employer has the right to either give you other work for those 3 hours, which is equivalent in difficulty to the job you agreed to do. And if they don't have another job to give you, which is equivalent in terms of the physical exertion that original job required, they have to pay you as an idle worker. Meaning they pay you and deduct a certain amount of money because you've got to get paid for doing nothing. So you see that the halakha does relate to the difficulty of the job that you agreed to do, and it does matter. But again, I think it still depends upon how clear and thorough your agreement was. Okay? These can all be contingent upon particular considerations. Okay. In terms of, so the type of employee, let's try to cover the rest of this in the time that we have. In Jewish law, as some of you might see in the sources, there's a big distinction between what we call a kavlan and a poel. A kavlan is loosely translated as a contractor. It doesn't mean necessarily only someone who is getting other workers to work for them to do a job, but a contractor, meaning I am not working for you in terms of time. You might see it as it's a less permanent relationship. I'm hiring this kavlan, this contractor, to complete a particular task for me on their own time, and when they finish that task, I pay them. That's one type of worker, right? When you bring your clothes to dry cleaners. So, you know, you might agree to have them, they might say, I'll finish by Wednesday, but you're not there making sure they're working every hour. When they get around to it, they dry your clothes, they clean them, and you pay them when they're done. There's no time commitment there. As opposed to a poel, or in halacha, or what we call a schir yom, which is a timely worker, whereby I am committing my time. So if I agree to work for you from 9 to 5, I am committed to working from 9 to 5, I have to then work from 9 to 5 with, you know, whatever breaks are necessary, but it's my time that I'm committing to you. So before we get into distinctions between these, and there are a few, which do you think is a stronger commitment? And the question they ask, who is more committed to the employer, the timely worker or the contractor? The schirion or the kavlan? Any thoughts? Schirion. Schirion. You think you say that also?
The contractor has to do the job. Schirion has to, you know, work. Like, they're obligated to different things.
Good. So it's actually kind of a complex question. When, and you said schirion, why?
Because there's more oversight. There's like more specific, more sort of timeline.
Right. So on the one hand, there's really differing points on this. On the one hand, the schir yom is required to give their time. They have to work at certain times. It's not up to them to decide when to work and how to use their time. And that is a big commitment. It is so almost akin to the fact that I need to do certain things for you when you told me to do them. It's almost akin to what? Sort of like a type of servitude. And that's part of maybe where the Gemara's line comes in, where we don't want you to be certain servants. I don't have the decision to do what I want with my own time. However, a kavlan, a contractor, can decide to make their own decisions as to when they want to do a job. Number two, on the flip side, and I think this is what Jay was suggesting, on the flip side, in terms of what you're committed to do, you might suggest the poel, the worker, what he's really committing to is the effort. Meaning, what am I saying? I'm going to show up from 9 to 5 and be there and try to do my job. A contractor is committing to get the job done. It's the production that they're committing to. When you can imagine different circumstances where if for some reason it doesn't get done, there might be a distinction. Or in terms of the case, let's say, what I just mentioned, and then I'm just sort of rather adding here, these are all independent discussions that we can't go into fully. But in the case we mentioned before, where the job gets done earlier, I specify that I hire you to do a particular job, such as, again, cleaning my house, you clean my house in before the allotted time is over, do I have the right to then give you a different job? So if I'm committing my time to you, that's much more reasonable. Again, because even though I said the work I'm going to be doing for you is cleaning the house, but I also committed my time. And then maybe he has the right to then say, okay, look, what you really committed to do is giving me your effort for a certain amount of time. If I give you a comparable job with the same amount of effort in that time, that's fair. If I'm committing to finish a particular task, maybe that's not the case. Maybe I don't have the right to switch jobs on the contractor. Anyways, in regard to backing out, we also do have this distinction. Take a look at source number 12. So Rashi here already is suggesting that this idea that God doesn't want us to be servants to other people and only wants us to be servants to God doesn't apply to a kavlan, a contractor. Because since they can do the job on their own time, they're not really in servitude. They're only a servant to themselves. They're working for themselves. They're not really working for the employer. They get paid for it by the employer, but they're really doing their own job. Whereas a worker is bound to the time of the employer. And therefore, if you look at source number 13, so in terms of the effectiveness of a transaction, making this a personal commitment to finish the job and ensure that it gets done, Tosfot here distinguishes again between a kablan and a worker. And he says, look, if a worker was committed to give that time no matter what, that would be servitude. That would be servitude. That's what the Gemara says, no matter what. Even if you sign a contract or get paid or hand over a handkerchief, it doesn't matter. You still have the ability to back out of such an arrangement. However, a kablan, that's not applicable. He or she can do the job on their own time. Therefore, if they write a contract, they have to get it done. No matter what, it's not that they can back out and suffer the consequences. They absolutely have to make sure the job gets done. And again, it also makes sense in light of the fact that what the kavlan is committing to is not just their time, but to ensuring the task is completed. So part of this discussion, in terms of the nature of an employment agreement, might depend upon the type of worker that you are. Okay, so with the number of the few minutes we have left, I'd like to then discuss the financial ramifications of backing out. If you take a look at source number 14, I'd actually like to read through it quickly and then discuss. The Gemara actually enumerates a number of different circumstances as to what you're liable for and when you're liable. Let's take a look at source number 14. This is the Gemara in Bava Metzia 76b. Says the Gemara, Bamed varim marumim, and this refers to the comment before. When do we say that you are not financially liable for backing out of the agreement? Shalom hechilu b'malacha. That's when you didn't begin working. Aval hechilu b'malacha, if you did begin working, now we're going to have two opinions. So before we continue, you started working. You didn't just verbally agree. You started the job. So say, for instance, and the Gemara assumes this is a task-based job. So I agree to what the Gemara is going to say. So two articles of clothing for you. I sewed one, and now I stopped. So what do I get paid for? And let's say, for instance, now, since I didn't sew the second article of clothing, the person who wanted their clothing sewn is going to have to pay more money to get that job done. So, that might be a consideration. It's not clear from the Gemara whether that makes difference or not. But that's the question. Now that the cost of labor has risen, is the employee liable for that? He or she committed to doing two for a lesser price. Now that they backed out, the employer is in trouble. So what happens? What would you say, just before we mention the two different opinions? Should they be liable for that? Meaning?
If you hire someone to tailor to the article of clothing, you can only tailor one. You pick up the one they get and find another tailor for the other one. There's no...
Oh, because they can find someone else.
They can find someone else to do it.
Let's say they can't for the same price. It's going to cost more money.
Oh.
Wouldn't it depend upon the suggestion we agreed to originally? Again, if... That's fair, but I did tell you to do two. Right? I told you to do two. So that was the arrangement. You're going to do two, and now you only did one. That's not fair. So this, I would think, should depend on, again, did I commit myself to finishing? Did I commit my assets to finishing on that price? Or do I commit to nothing, really, and I get paid for whatever I do? So this is indeed an argument. We'll just go over these two lines. So actually, let's read it quickly. So the Gemara says here, Ketzad, if you look at that second little paragraph, Kiblu kamalik tzor b'shnei slayim. I agree to harvest the stock for two slayim, two coins. Katzru chetzev nichu chetzia. And I cut half of it and left half of it. Begela ro b'shnei slayim, or I agree to weave, and actually one article of clothing, for two sellas, two coins. Argu chetzev nichu. Vinicho, chetzio. And I weave half of it, I left the remaining half. Shamin lahen and masha asu. You assess what they've already done. Hayaya feshisha dinrim, notain lahem sela. Oh, yim rumalatam, yit lushne slaim, vim sela, notain lahem sela. Says the Gemara here, to make a long story short, you don't get penalized. According to this first opinion, I get paid for all the labor I did, regardless of the appreciation in the price of labor. Even though the employer now has to pay more, doesn't matter. That's not my problem. And Rabbi Dosa disagrees. Ridos omer shamin lahem mash atid lehe asot. Hayaya fesh shisha dinrim, notem lahem shakel, o yingrim lahatan, vietnu shle slaim, v'im sela notem lahem sela. And Rabbi Dosa disagrees. He says, no, now that I have to pay, the employer has to pay more, I lose from my salary. So if I did half of the job, let's say for argument's sake, I was going to be paid $5 for half of that job, and now he has to pay $7 for the second half of the job, I only get paid $3. Now, you could have suggested you should get paid nothing. Because I committed to doing the whole job, I did half of it. Right? So it's interesting. The Gemara sort of has a compromise here. Another case the Gemara suggests here, we'll have to cover outside for a second, is what if it's a case where I'll lose money? So let's say the case the Gemara gives is, if you hire someone to, the case is you put flax and you're soaking it in water, I guess, to treat it so that you can appropriately process it. And if you soak it for too long, it's going to get ruined. And I hire the workers to get the flax out of the water, and they don't. And now if I don't get it out soon, I'm going to lose all that material. That was the case you mentioned before. Are they liable? So the Gemara there says something really interesting. From the Gemara itself, it seems, I'm not liable for the entire price of flax, but the employer has recourse to make sure it gets done. Either by, according to a simple explanation at least, either by taking all the money I would have been paid and offering that to another worker to finish the job. So if I would have been paid $10 for what I've already done, and now it's going to cost more than that to finish the job, I can take all those $10 and add that. Or I can even trick them into finishing the job. The Gemara says, I can offer the original workers who quit more money. I'll say, I'll pay you double. And then when they actually do it, only pay them the original amount. So I have ways of ensuring the job gets done, but not. It's interesting enough to according to the Gemara, get full recourse. However, there are Rishonim who do suggest that you do, if you actually lose money, you also had recourse to the entire sum of money that you lost from the worker. So unfortunately, we're not going to get to fully, completely discuss the ins and outs of the financial ramifications of quitting. But I think we do see, what I've tried to demonstrate then, is that in terms of all the complexities of can you back out, when can you back out, and the ramifications for backing out, I think it does depend on how you conceptually understand the employee-employer relationship, what is the nature of that commitment, and in terms of each case, you have to discuss the type of worker. And with all of these concepts, you sort of have to wiggle into each detail as to how to contort and make him work for all halacha, which are actually discussed in the Gemara. Thank you again very much for all your time. I know it was a difficult and complex topic. Thank you for the attention that you gave and your analysis. And we hope that you come and join us again for learning at another point soon.
Gemara is key b'nei Yisrael avadayhem.